Welcome to the Sunstone Podcast, everyone, where there is always more than one way to Mormon. I'm Stephen Carter, and I'm here to introduce this episode. The Utah Department of Health confirmed the state's first cases of AIDS in 1983. How did gay and lesbian people in Utah respond to this new disease? How did the LDS Church respond? And how did other religious communities in Utah respond? And what, if any, support did they offer? What laws were passed in response to AIDS? And who were some of the heroes of this time? Interestingly enough, the answers are not as predictable as you might think. Our presenter is J. Seth Anderson. He has a master's degree in history from the University of Utah and is a PhD candidate in history at Boston University. He's the author of LGBT Salt Lake, and he and his husband, Dr. Michael Ferguson, were the first same-sex couple legally married in Utah in December 2013.
So as I write in my book, LGBT Salt Lake is a town full of secrets. Some secrets are hidden intentionally, others are hidden in plain sight. And one of these hidden histories is the history of what we now call the LGBT community in Utah. And it's this area of history that I have chosen to invest my life's work. I believe that LGBT history is a part of Utah history and that we cannot understand where we are as Americans or as Utahns without knowing this history, including our sexual past. Okay, so I'm going to turn my attention to HIV in Utah, and I want to highlight the people and when we became aware of HIV in Utah. I want to disrupt the common binary that makes us think that all religions were antagonistic to the gay and lesbian community and people with AIDS, because that's not true. And I want to highlight some stories of the valiant efforts of countless people in the community who did all they could to care for people with AIDS. And then I'm going to highlight some of the AIDS activists in Utah. For some perspective really quick, though, it's important to know demographics and what Utah looked like. So in New York, for example, in 1980, there was an estimated 600,000 gay men in the city in 1980. By comparison, there was only 163,000 people total in all of Salt Lake City. So that's a huge difference. For example, by 1987, the Utah State Health Department had documented 60 cases of AIDS with 43 deaths, which is a really high mortality rate. By contrast, New York estimated that there was about 11,500 cases of AIDS that same year. By contrast, in 1986, we know that over 400 people tested positive for HIV in Utah, making it a major epidemic. But to me, these lower numbers make the story so much more interesting. I ask, how did a smaller group of people with fewer resources and in a much different cultural and religious climate understand the disease? And how did they care for those who were infected? Where were the places of care in Utah? And what were the boundaries of grace? The history of AIDS treatment in Utah would look nothing like it does if it wasn't for the arrival of Dr. Kristen Reese to Utah in 1981. Dr. Reese was a Quaker who grew up in Pennsylvania. She went to med school in Pennsylvania. And she came to Utah as an infectious disease specialist in 1981. She became the leading expert on HIV and AIDS in the state and was the only doctor for many years in Utah who would treat people with AIDS. We can split hairs on that claim, but I stick with it. I said something on Facebook a year or two ago about that, and these queens came out of the woodwork to like be like, no, that's not true. But she really was. Like, she's told me that if she needed a brain scan, like, because she didn't have all the things, but if she had a patient who needed a brain scan, she could call a doctor in town and be like, hey, I have a patient, can I send them up to you? And they would say, yeah, but like, do it at the end of the day. Like, I don't want him to be seen in the waiting room. Or if she needed some other thing. So some doctors would help when she asked, but nobody like her opened their doors and advertised themselves as treating people with AIDS. She was the only one who did. By 1985, she was treating 50 people with AIDS in her private practice by herself, and that number kept growing every single month. She was known in town for the compassionate care that she gave her patients. She accepted drop-in appointments. She made house calls and traveled around the state to meet with people. And she took people who didn't have insurance. In an interview with the HIV/AIDS Oral History Project that I'm a part of here at the University of Utah, she recalled the climate within the medical community during these years. And this climate wasn't unique to Utah. The fear and the stigma and the unknown, all those variables shaped the way that people talked about and spoke about people with AIDS. So Dr. Reese told me this story where she was out one day in town grocery shopping or something, and she bumped into an oncologist that she knew, and they got to talking, struck up a conversation, oh, how's work? And the oncologist said, man, you know, I don't know what's worse, my cancer patient's dying or your patient's dying. And then she paused and she said, oh, wait, yes, I do. Yours deserve it. So given this climate, it is not a stretch to say that without Dr. Reese in Utah, the vast majority of people with AIDS would have received subpar medical care if they had received any at all. Dr. Reese had admitting privileges to Holy Cross Hospital, which was the Catholic hospital in town. And that's where she met Maggie Snyder, who was a nurse there. Nurse Snyder, by that time, was primarily caring for people with HIV and AIDS. And in 1988, Dr. Reese asked her if she would consider becoming a physician assistant to help her with her growing caseload. And Maggie did. She became a PA. And then in 1994, the women moved their practice and 500 patients with HIV to Clinic 1A up here at the University of Utah Hospital. Since 1987, the Utah Pride Festival has awarded a deserving person in town with the Dr. Kristen Reese Award. It's a very prestigious award, and she was the first recipient. Enough cannot be said about the heroic efforts of these two women who worked long hours with no time off for nearly a decade, treating people who were among the most despised and feared. I'm very pleased that I actually know them, and I was here last summer doing research, and they had me over for dinner, and it was like one of the best nights where it was just me. Maggie's from Texas, and she had some Texas whiskey, and it was just me and Maggie sitting around the table drinking whiskey, talking about all the things, and it was a very happy moment. Although it's impossible to know with certainty when AIDS arrived in Utah, the health department confirmed the first cases of AIDS in 1983 and began compiling statistics on AIDS that year. Byron Haslam of the state's Bureau of Communicable Disease made the first public acknowledgement of AIDS in Utah in July 1983. He assured Utahns that AIDS is, what he said, nothing for the general public to worry about. If you're talking about homosexuals or intravenous drug users, heroin users, then the risks are relatively high. But for the general public, there's little, if any, risk. He implied with this statement that homosexuals do not count as part of the general public of Utah, underscoring the idea of homosexuals as outsiders and guilty of something. Haslam used the term AIDS correctly to talk about the disease, but he, like many others, may not fully have recognized that AIDS could and did infect heterosexuals, or in his words, the general population. But this statement tells us that by 1983, AIDS had been spreading in Utah. In 1985, a 24-year-old man named Claire Harwood from Ogden went to speak with his Mormon bishop. Harwood had been diagnosed with AIDS in 1984, and his doctors told him that he only had months to live. Penitent and facing his mortality, Howard sought out his bishop for spiritual guidance during his darkest hours. What happened next made national news. Bishop Bruce Don Bowen told Howard not to return to church and excommunicated him. Howard later told the press that his family and that his friends had abandoned him, that he had no money, that he had no way to work, that he had nowhere to live. And he said to the press, there was just so much guilt. I was going nuts, and I was convinced I'd go to hell if I did not speak to the bishop. I just wanted peace of mind. When the story became national news, LDS Church spokesman Jerry Cahill told the press that the church had no official guidelines for people with AIDS, but that people with AIDS should consider the possible consequences of spreading the disease if they attended church meetings. This statement reflects a concern about contagion, a concern shared by many Americans during the 80s, especially around AIDS, because it wasn't until October 1986 when the United States Attorney General, C. Everett Koop, released the first national report on AIDS that a majority of Americans actually had access to information about modes of transmission and methods of protection. So this is Claire. This was the picture of him that ran with the story. And this picture presents a fairly iconic view of how the mainstream media presented people with AIDS. Howard does not look at the camera. Rather, he diverts his gaze downward, suggesting shame and vulnerability and fear. Second, the Kaposi sarcoma lesions cover his young body, making obvious the reality of his life living with AIDS. As my advisor says, AIDS was a disease written on the body. Finally, in this picture, he's pictured alone and isolated, except for that framed photograph hanging on the wall behind him. And I'm not certain, but the outline of the building in the frame, to me, looks like the temple in Ogden, the old one before they redid it. If so, then the photo suggests the ever-present influence of the Mormon Church in the lives of gay and lesbian Mormons and in the lives of people with AIDS. Historian of religion Anthony Petro has noted that culturally we perceive a historical opposition between Christianity and gay liberation. But he argues that this perception has overlooked the long record of religious engagement with gays and lesbians, including at times support for gay and lesbian rights. So he believes that this perception of gays versus religion stems partly from the over-representation of conservative religious figures who are then made to stand in for religion in general. But one of the most exciting parts of my research is breaking down this binary. I'm a queer theorist at heart, and I'm really suspicious of binaries, which isn't to say that there wasn't antagonism. There wasn't a tension between gay Mormons and and the Mormon Church. I'm not denying that. I'm saying that that answer is just too reductive. But with any regional history of Utah, one has to include an examination of the LDS Church's influence and the role, their role in the state. The two just cannot be untangled. My interests with this research really do not lie with proving how homophobic or AIDS-phobic the Brighamite sect of the Restoration was or is. I'm just not interested in that. But since the church has great influence and since AIDS touched the lives of so many people in Utah in so many various ways, I have to address what the LDS Church did and didn't do. And then I'm going to talk about some other denominations in Utah and what they did or didn't do. So until 1987, church leadership made no statement about HIV or AIDS in Utah. The church also offered little to no help to people with AIDS publicly. But the research that I've been doing for the project that I'm working on here shows that the LDS Church actually did help in some ways, but it was always in secret. So for example, Dr. Reese recalled a story where an official from the church came into her office and wrote a check for $25,000. And the person told her, "This is to take care of our families with AIDS." In other words, women and children. And that's an interesting distinction because they didn't say take care of people with AIDS, but to be used for families, which Dr. Reese understood was to go towards women and children, i.e. the innocent, the victims of AIDS. Another example comes from 1990. And I love this one. The church was converting the Hotel Utah into the Joseph Smith Memorial Building. And an anonymous caller from the church called the Salt Lake AIDS Foundation, which I'm going to talk about in just a second. And they told her that they had furniture from the Hotel Utah that they were willing to donate to the AIDS Foundation, but on one condition. And that condition was that they never tell anybody where it came from. So in a very real way, the Mormon church furnished the first AIDS educational foundation in Utah, but secretly. The first time that members of the church publicly spoke about the reality of HIV and AIDS among Mormons was actually at this conference in 1986, in not one, but in two sessions. First session was titled Out of the Closet, Into the Fire, and it featured two Mormon psychologists, two Mormon gay men, and a mother, Mormon mother of a gay man. And then later that night, Carolyn Pearson spoke to a crowd of over 900 about her book, Goodbye, I Love You, which had recently been published. Pearson's book challenged her Mormon audience by putting a Mormon face not only on homosexuality, but on AIDS. And it's one of just those watershed moments in the history of AIDS and Mormonism. Then at General Conference in 87, then-Apostle Gordon B. Hinckley mentioned homosexuality and AIDS. This talk is significant for several reasons. First, he acknowledged that people in Utah, including members of the church, were living with AIDS. And second, he assuaged fears by reminding members that they had a responsibility to help people in need, although he didn't say how, he didn't say where to find information. And third, the talk helped to open up more dialogue about AIDS, but kept church policy about the sinfulness of homosexuality firmly in place. He reminds the listeners during that talk that the wages of sin is death. Because Hinckley's talk is the first time a general authority spoke about AIDS publicly after years of ignoring it, his words shaped public discourse in and outside of the church in 1987. But as I've indicated, the church was giving assistance behind the scene while the public rhetoric still drew the distinction between innocent and guilty. An Episcopal bishop in Utah urged prayers and empathy for people with AIDS in 1986. The then newly ordained Episcopal bishop, the Right Reverend George E. Bates was his name, he wrote a pastoral letter that was read at the principal service of each Utah congregation on November 9th, 1986. And he said, "AIDS is not a disease which has smitten only one segment of our society. All too often it is identified with the homosexual community. Sadly, some Christians will claim that AIDS is a sign of the wrath of God visited upon that particular community. There is no room for such thought in the body of Christ. God does not cause people to suffer. Rather, God suffers with his people, including those who have AIDS." The letter further urged people to become familiar with educational materials regarding AIDS, and the document called upon the federal government to devote its resources to research and treatment of the disease. He concluded the letter by stating that Christ calls upon us to go beyond the myth and fear of an illness, which at present is incurable. He calls us to work and pray for healing and understanding. Catholic nuns were among the first to treat people with AIDS, not only in Utah, but nationally. The Catholic Church, Holy Cross, treated the majority of people with AIDS in Utah. This is partly because, not partly, largely because Dr. Reese had admitting privileges there. So all her many patients funneled through her that she funneled to Holy Cross. In 1987, the nuns at Holy Cross created Med-3, which was the state's first 10-bed inpatient unit for people with AIDS. The nuns even distributed condoms. Even though the Catholic Church explicitly forbid contraception, the nuns rationalized that since the condoms were not going to be used to prevent a birth or a pregnancy, but that they were going to be used to prevent a disease, that they weren't violating policy. And I was like, that's kind of brilliant. Good for them. So that's some of the religious response. Now I'm going to look at the state. The state government allocated no money to the growing epidemic, but did receive a grant from the Center for Disease Control in March 1986. They received a little over $117,000 to create programs aimed at controlling and preventing the spread of HIV. However, state epidemiologist Craig Nichols refused to use any of the money to distribute information on safe sex, including information about condom use, which in 1987, 86, like, you gotta talk about it. That is exactly how you're gonna prevent HIV. Wouldn't do it. But he told the press in 86, he said, "We will do the things we know we can do and that are acceptable. And other groups will have to fill in where they think there's a deficit." By that time, grassroots efforts had been doing exactly that. In 84, there were no organizations established in Salt Lake with a specific purpose of assisting people with AIDS. If anybody had a question about it, they could obtain information by calling an out-of-state agency, or, you know, if they were lucky, to hunt down any kind of printed information about it. There was a local gay rights activist in town named Becky Moss, who was a co-host of a radio show called Concerning Gays and Lesbians. And once a month, she dedicated an episode to AIDS education. People who had already had HIV, had already contracted HIV, could get a physician referral from the Utah Community Services Center and Clinic, which was a gay-owned and operated clinic, and they most often, you know, referred them to Dr. Reese. But the if you were HIV positive in 84, 85, you didn't have a peer support group at all. And in some cases, people with insufficient support from family or friends sought out help from therapists who were not trained at all or ready to or prepared to deal with the horrors of AIDS. But then in the summer of 1985, a sudden transformation occurred in Salt Lake. Almost simultaneously, people from the Salt Lake gay and lesbian population organized a variety of service organizations to support people with AIDS and educate the public. So quickly did these develop that most of the new groups had not even heard of the others at the time of their founding. Three organizations in particular stand out. First is Don Bramble. He was a priest chaplain. He was part of an organization called Dignity, which was a group for gay Catholics, much like Affirmation for gay Mormons. Second, Patty Reagan. She created the Salt Lake AIDS Foundation. She was a doctor and had just returned to Utah from doing work at Berkeley, where she had been involved with the AIDS research project there. And since her expertise was in health education, she felt that she should and could start educating the public. So to do this, she created the Salt Lake AIDS Foundation, which she said she named after the San Francisco AIDS Foundation. And it was the first organization in Utah that had a hotline that you could call and get information. She paid for that with her out of her own pocket, and she staffed the line regularly so that when people called, they could get information, accurate information that they were looking for. She said in an interview that a lot of times people would call thinking it was like a hookup line. Finally, one of the most ambitious efforts was called AIDS Project Utah. It was founded by Dwayne Dawson. APU, as it was called, worked with patients at the hospital and acted as liaison between the various health departments. APU trained volunteers to work with the physical and emotional needs of people who had AIDS and provided practical support such as transportation, taking people to doctor's appointments, or buying groceries, or bathing and cleaning people with AIDS. In 1988, the then executive director, Ben Barr, helped to bring the AIDS memorial quilt called the NAMES Project to Utah in 1988. Fundraising had been underway since 1985 thanks to the efforts of the Royal Court of the Golden Spike Empire, which had been established as a gay and lesbian nonprofit in 1976. It's actually the oldest, what we would now say, LGBT nonprofit in Utah. And they combined like this kind of campy, drag, royalty aesthetic with nonprofit work. So they all had titles like Emperor and Empress and Princess and Duchess. And so Emperor Scott Stites in 1986, Emperor here would mean like executive director basically, he launched the first AIDS Awareness Week. And the Royal Court that year raised over $10,000 for people with AIDS. I'm still astounded by this flyer when he gave me this. And this is 1986. And those are all gay owned and operated businesses, churches, support groups. I'm astounded that there was that many in Salt Lake in 1986. Outside of Salt Lake, there were small AIDS education groups that organized in Ogden and St. George. Courtney Mosier told me in an interview for the History Project that when he learned about a particular area up in the mountains in Cache Valley where gay men would go to hike and to cruise for sex, that he set up a hot dog stand at the trailhead every Wednesday night. He called it Weenie World. And he'd hand out hot dogs to men who would come up to go hiking, and he'd give them a hot dog and then talk to them about safe sex. It became like a kind of an institution. They did it for 10 years. He and other volunteers also hung condom dispensers that they had made out of milk jugs along the trail. And he said that they had to fill them three times a week In St. George, a small group of activists formed the AIDS Task Force of Southern Utah in the early 90s. It got all of its training and information from a group called Aid for AIDS Nevada, which was based in Las Vegas. Because the distance from St. George to Salt Lake was so much greater, they got all their information and training from Nevada. And when people were sick, they would send them to Las Vegas for care, not to Salt Lake. Then in 1987, the legislature began to discuss the topic of AIDS for the first time. They passed the first law related to HIV, which was known as the Common Law Marriage Act. And in short, this law made null and void, was the words in the bill, in the law, null and void any marriage of a person who was HIV positive. When I first learned about that and read about it, I thought it was like a total attack on closeted gay Mormon men, but in the research that I've done, it really wasn't. It was a total incompetence. They didn't know what they were doing. So it's called the Common Law Marriage Act, right? And so it was about passing a law that would make common law marriage legal in Utah, which had never been the case because of polygamy. Right. So what they were trying to do, what they argued they were doing, was if the guy said people who hold themselves out as being married. So if it was a guy and a woman, man and woman who lived together and had kids but didn't get married, if those relationships split up, then the woman would go to the state for welfare benefits instead of the ex-husband for like alimony or something. So they said they were trying to close up this loophole of welfare fraud by basically forcing people to be married legally. And then they like added this AIDS part that was like, and people with AIDS are not married. It's seriously weird. It doesn't make any sense. But this law was challenged in 93 by two HIV-positive women, both married to men, and both mothers. One of the women was named Peggy Tingey. Peggy actually was Becky Moss's sister. She had contracted HIV from a boyfriend who was a drug user when she lived in Chicago. And she got sick and she came back to Utah. In 1989, she tested positive as HIV, but she then met that guy right there. And they got married in 1989. And she gave birth to a boy in 1990. His name was Chance. Chance was born HIV positive. And the two of them from then on were kind of public faces of HIV and AIDS in Utah. They traveled around the state and gave presentations talking about their lives living with AIDS, her life as a mother with AIDS, and the mother of a child with AIDS. So being in all this AIDS awareness work, somebody told her, well, you know, there's a law that was passed in 87 that makes your marriage void. And so they were very confused by that, of course, kind of freaked out. What did that mean then in terms of inheritance? Or was her daughter right there on the right, what was her relationship then to this man that she thought she was married to if their marriage was void? The case goes before a judge in 1993. Of course, it's overturned as unconstitutional. But by this time, she and Chance were both living with AIDS. The disease had progressed to AIDS. They didn't have much longer to live. Chance passed away in 1994, and then Peggy died a year later. Another young AIDS activist in Utah was named Tyler Spriggs. He was diagnosed with AIDS at age 2. He was born to an HIV-positive mother. And as he got older and learned to talk, he and his adopted mother traveled around the state educating people about AIDS, just like Peggy and Chance had been doing. And when asked about being a kid with AIDS and what his life was like, he famously said, "When I get really tired, I'll go live with Jesus, but I'm not tired yet." He passed away just before his 9th birthday in 1994, and his obituary read, said, "Today I finally got tired and decided to join my friends Haley, Chance, Eugene, and my Aunt Mary." Death permeated the lives of gay men and people with AIDS in Utah, in the nation, and around the globe. In a book titled The Calendar of Loss, English professor Dagmawi Wobschet argues that mourning, the act of mourning, is profoundly political, specifically when it came to AIDS-related deaths, because those who were being mourned were also the people who were despised. People within the gay and lesbian community, of course, mourned their friends, the deaths of their friends and their partners, but society actively repressed that mourning and often refused to acknowledge these deaths. This is very clear in obituaries, not just in Utah, but kind of everywhere. If the family was very ashamed that their son was gay or that he had died from AIDS, they never said it. If he had a partner who had taken care of him for years and years, never mentioned him. But there were clues. If you knew what to look for, you could figure it out. Oftentimes, the age of the person was an indicator. Men in their 20s and 30s don't just drop dead for no reason. And if it had been something like cancer or like a tragic car accident, the family said that. But if it didn't say anything, it was generally AIDS. They also would sometimes say like he was a very gifted musician or loved the theater or something like that. And oftentimes in Utah, the family would say, you know, "We thank the staff at Holy Cross." That was a clue. Or sometimes they would even say, "We thank Dr. Reese." So this grief, though, of those mourning became invisible until groups deployed mourning strategies to make the deaths of people from AIDS public. For example, the AIDS Memorial Quilt. That was a strategy to do just that. And if you've ever seen any of archival footage on YouTube of when they were unfurled, like the panels on the National Mall, it's very sad. Very moving, though, to see these people publicly grieving. And then also ACT UP was an AIDS activist group. They sometimes, in their protests, would throw the ashes of their partners and their friends onto the White House lawn. Culturally, we are taught a way to mourn, a proper way to mourn, which is that you grieve for a time, you kind of get over it, and then you move on. Like, grandma's sick, and you know she's going to die, and you're sad when she does, but then, you know, it's going to happen. But this idea is based on an idea that death comes in small, manageable portions, meaning that you lose one person at a time and can deal with it. But with AIDS, this model was utterly impossible, since people lost friends and lovers and family members so rapidly. In every interview I've ever done, and in pretty much every book I've ever done, for people who lived through AIDS, when they talk about it, they will very often talk about it as being in a battle, or being on a battlefield, or being at war, and talking about how just the watching everybody just kind of fall, and not knowing why they were still alive. And in addition, many of those people who were grieving were also meditating on their own imminent death, since they were dying from the same disease that just killed all their friends. So the people who lived through this time carry with them a deep sense of survivor's guilt. In an interview with me, community activist Ben Williams noted the profound guilt that he and many of his generation feel for surviving the epidemic while so many of their friends died. And he told me, "AIDS was a plague that hit my generation. It made my adult life feel like wartime, and I was incredibly sad and scared all the time." He noted, though, that the plague proved how sterling and how honorable the gay and lesbian community was. He said, "We took care of each other. The lesbians jumped right in to take care of us when we gay men faltered. AIDS made us feel like a community. I think we became a stronger community because of it." AIDS came to Utah in the 1980s and ravished the lives of many people. The gay and lesbian community in Utah did not back down to this fight against AIDS. With resilience and persistence, they faced hostility from the medical community, from the law, from their families, and oftentimes from their church. But they fought the disease because they wanted to live. And from love, they fought because they knew that their lives mattered. AIDS changed the world in profound and permanent ways, and we live in its legacy. AIDS is still not over. So I'm going to conclude with the call of activists before me. ACT UP, fight back, fight AIDS. Thank you.